Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and really have been looking forward to this event for a while, and so is Barbara. It's a real delight to welcome our good friend, Denise Mina, or should I say Dame Denise Mina, to our virtual event here today. And Denise is going to be talking about her two new books, The Three Fires and The Second Murderer. And so Barbara and I are going to be kind of tag teaming the interview today. So Barbara, did you want to start off with Three Fires?
I think I will, because I think the main thrust really ought to be talking about the Raymond Chandler, but I'm so enchanted with this book. And I love Denise, the way that you write these kind of political books, but in a historical context. And what makes this one so much fun? I mean, basically we're in the 1400s, 15th century Florence, but the prose is very modern in lots of ways. So you must have had a lot of fun deciding what voice to write this little tract in.
And, you know, it was a radio program. So if you get the British one, it says, as heard on Radio 4.
Ah.
So it was done in the voice of P.G. Woodhouse. And it was basically that story. So it's a very serious story about the first populist leader in sort of modern history. And I thought I could publish this as a book. And then I tried to I sent it to the editor, and he said, no, this won't work on the page, because so much of it was in the delivery. It was written to be read out. So I had to write another whole book. And so he was the editor for Rizzio, and which was the other historical one. You and I talked about that because you're a Mary Queen of Scots nerd. I can say that. And he said, you know, it really needs rewritten. So I got to get back into all the research and basically told it in Savonarola's voice, because he's the most boring puritanical man. He's basically a sort of prototype Puritan. And he's in Florence with the Medici, with Michelangelo, with Botticelli, with Da Vinci. He's the most boring man in the town. So he doesn't really very often get centered in the story, but he's an amazing man. And he did basically a number of miracles that no one ever talks about, apart from very, very Catholic Italians. You know, as he was being killed for preaching that the Catholic Church was corrupt, he'd been dead for an hour and they were hanging his body, and his hand rose up and blessed the crowd. This is when his feet are on fire. Now, we know that it was because he was wearing a cassock and his sleeves were very wide, and he basically had been fasting for months. So he's a little weedy man and his arms are withered. The sleeves fill up with hot air. His hand comes up, the air goes out of the sleeve and the hand comes back down. But it still was a miracle. I mean, it's just a really kind of enchanting story, but it's all true.
It is all true. And, you know, you're so right that he was a populist. He was basically a human wrecking ball, like another current leader that we could mention here in the United States. And it's interesting. I was talking to Brad Thor, which is a totally different kind of a book, but part of his book is talking about our addiction to anger. And, you know, I think that an addiction to anger is really what you bring across so much with Savannah. I love this passage too, because this is the context. Florence is full of drunks and courtesans and open sodomite marketplaces, but it is also a city of beautiful art and architecture. It's the San Francisco of its day. Tolerant, vibrant, interesting, well-run and ordered. Even the children look well-fed. It prospers. So, you know, this is the stage against which this angry, puritanical, you know, demagogue decides that he's going to wage war, and he is going to feed enough anger that he's going to be, you know, we think of him as the book burner, but it was a whole lot more than that, wasn't it?
And fear. I mean, the thing about Savonarola is he was a terrible preacher. So he spent 10 years touring the provinces, learning how to preach. And he watched what worked. And the thing that really worked was a certain accent so people felt that he was one of them, and making people frightened. That really, you will never go broke making people frightened. And so he tells them that, you know, that the world is coming to an end, that God is going to set fire to all of them, that you don't trust anybody who doesn't agree with you. And actually he's quoted, there's a Machiavelli quote at the very beginning, and it's Machiavelli says, Savonarola was a brilliant leader. He managed to whip everyone up. His big mistake was he then didn't have an army to enforce his views. So he couldn't sustain it, because it's all frothy emotionalism, you know. There's no substance to it. And he does this really interesting thing of being astute and identifying things. He says the poor are not poor because they're lazy. They're poor because they're not paid well. They're not paid properly for the work. He says bankers are charging too much. They set up a credit union in Florence. And he segues almost immediately from those observations into, and that's why we have to kill all the Jews. So there's, you know, these observations that make you open up towards them, and then suddenly he suggests a course of action that is irrelevant to the point that he's observed. You see Modi doing that in India, you see Erdogan, you see you know, all these populists, Boris Johnson. It's the same the world over. It's always the same act, you know. And I was just struck by the parallels. I mean, it's staggering. It's a very old act, works every time.
Well, it really is. And yet, you know, you also point out that some of, you know, Martin Luther's theses were rooted in a few points that Savonarola makes. For example, the intervention of priests isn't necessary to reach God. God speaks straight to his people. But then, of course, you know, the demagogue will make himself, you know, that channel in which God is speaking to the people. And, you know, it's a way of using faith, you know, to reinforce whatever it all is. And, you know, we see the Christian evangelicals in America, you know, are such a part of our current divisiveness and so forth. And part of that is by, you know, calling on faith, ignoring science in favor of faith, you know, that kind of thing. I just thought your book's actually quite funny in places. I love the voice, but I thought it's a very serious subject, and it's all done in like 134 books or 34 pages or something. But I think this is a really powerful story, historically true, but incredibly relevant today. And, you know, those of us who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, although it seems to me that there are always enough people that don't know history that we always wind up in a recycle, right?
Yeah, and I think also some people who do know history get tips from it, Barbara. So, you know what I mean? I mean, sometimes people are looking at people like Savonarola and they're thinking, oh, that's how you do it. Okay, so you need a uniform. You know, God speaks directly to the people, but then you change who the people are. The people are only men. He didn't want to talk to women. He didn't want any birth control. He didn't want to talk to Jews. He thought we should just kill all gays. And interestingly, as soon as he introduced that, no one made a complaint about anyone being gay in Florence. Nobody. And it's just the whole city said, yeah, that's absolutely right. It is dreadful. But that's their cousin and their brother and their father, and you know, maybe their husband, and, you know, in a very small, it was really interesting, the equal marriage thing in Ireland. The reason it changed was because mothers who had gay sons and gay nephews all voted for it against the wishes of the church. So it is that filial connection really protects people sometimes, you know? Anyway, I forgot what I was talking about, but he's just such an amazing character, Savonarola. As he was an amazing person, and the thing is, I disagree with him fundamentally, but I do think he was sincere, and you can't but love somebody who's sincere, you know. Whereas, I mean, I think Donald Trump, I don't even think he's genuinely racist. I just think he just thinks that'll sell, you know.
I think he's a human wrecking ball, and you know, whatever it takes to accomplish that. Is what he's willing to do. He's a huckster and a hustler, you know, and a grifter, which is an entirely different thing than somebody who is, you know, rooted in belief and in sincerity. So we'll see, you know, we'll see. I think, you know, looking at Putin, you have to think that he actually does believe that Russia should restore its empire and, you know, should be an imperial power. Whether he's right, you know, or wrong isn't really the question, but I think he actually does believe it. So there we are. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about, but I can't tell you how much I like this book. And I think everybody should read it because it's very thought-provoking, as well as I said, the dialogue is so great. I hadn't even thought of Woodhouse, but you're right. There, there is a Woodhousian nature to Denise's comments about how it all goes. So besides, you could learn some history. Not a bad thing. All right, Patrick, over to you, because I have not read The Second Murderer to my sorrow. So I'm going to listen to what you have to say.
Well, Denise, I absolutely loved it.
I'm always, as
maybe you are too, I'm always a little dubious about, you know, people trying to do something like this. And, you know, we've all read various examples of it where it just didn't, you know, they made the good effort, but it just didn't really capture what made Chandler Chandler, I guess, you know. And so I wanted to kind of talk to you a little bit about that. I mean, and boy, you really get it, you know, from my perspective. Everything, all those unique attributes about Chandler that we can get into to talk about. But it just occurred to me the number three and then the second murderer. And so maybe we could start by talking about the significance of the title. And it comes from Richard III, right?
Yeah, it's actually in Farewell, My Lovely. And yeah, it is. He talks about the second murderer, that scene in Richard III. And he says, you know, there's a scene where there's a murderer and he's reluctant to do the murder, but he really wants the money. So he kind of hesitates. And and somebody gave me a first edition copy of Raymond Chandler's notebooks. And one of the things was a list of possible titles. And one of the possible titles was The Second Murderer.
Really?
So, so that's where it comes from. So you can nerd out because, I mean, I love research, as you know, and I went quite deep.
Well, yeah, let's just talk about how did you get the gig in the first place? And how did you approach? Did you go back and read all the books? Did you just immerse yourself in the voice? And
what an interesting process it is, because I'm very wary when people get an estate gig. I think like everyone else, that what happens is they offer you a huge amount of money. That's not what happens. What they say is, do you love this writer? And you say, I love Chandler. And they say, would you like to try and write a Chandler book? So then you have to come up with some sample chapters to see if you've got the voice, an outline, and you send that to the estate, right? And the estate is a board of people. So the book is about someone's artistic estate, because I think that's so interesting. And they're amazing people. They're so interesting. And I spoke to them. I had a Zoom meeting with them and I said, look, I would love to do this, but I'm so interested in what you're all doing here. Can I interview all of you? So they let me interview all of them about how they came to be doing this job, you know, what their interest was in it. And what their experience of Chandler was. Some of them were personal, some of them were filial, some of them were, you know, they just were on boards of loads of things. But they were so open about it. It was lovely. Anyway, so then they said, right, okay, we want you to do it. Then you take it to a publisher and the publisher says, we want to publish this. And then the estate gets some of the money. So you're actually paying to do the job. It's very interesting. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's not what I thought it was at all. But I love Raymond Chandler, and I've always loved Raymond Chandler, and I love his early writing. Now, I think we know so much more about the progression of alcoholism now, but I think he descended into alcoholism, and you can really see that in his later writing. He becomes quite bitter, he's very racist, he's very misogynistic, but the early one where the voice is self-depreciating and he has some sense of perspective and he's in love with the city and he is a broken-hearted romantic, really, Marlowe. He's because when you're doing something like that, you're thinking, am I cosplaying Chandler? Am I LARPing Marlowe? What is the job to do here? You know, how could I make someone like me who loves Chandler enjoy this? What are the things that I really love about it? But then the more research I did, the more I realized he was doing Dashiell Hammett. And Dashiell Hammett was writing in the house style of the Pinkerton Agency, you know, whereas the Pinkerton Agency reports, they were told no adjectives, no adverbs, just facts, short, concise sentences. So it goes back and back and back. But anyway, so what I did was I read all the Chandler books again in order, and then I listened to them on audiobook as well to get the voice, and worked out the things that I really loved about them. I loved the aphorisms, you know, the metaphors, the love of language. You know, I really loved that people will recommend a Chandler book to you by saying there's this line in it. I think that's magical, you know. People don't say it's a great plot and you really find out what happens. Nobody ever says that, but Chandler, because they're just nonsense. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. But
people really love the writing, and that is, you know, that's such a magical thing. And do you know that he was at the same school as P.G. Wodehouse?
No.
Yeah, they missed each other by a term. They both went to Dulwich College in South London, and they had the same English masters.
I'll be darned.
And they both use aphorisms like that. So P.G. Wodehouse says things like, I legged it like a nymph surprised while bathing. And Marlowe says all the stuff he says, or Chandler says all the stuff he says. So I think they were taught by the same people and they learned the same basic style. So it's the same basic style, but going off in two very different directions, you know. But stylistically, they're very similar, I think. But anyway. Anyway, I did too much research. I think you can tell that. But so then I worked out, okay, so you want a story that romps along in this lovely world with this character at the start of his career, when he still believes in love and justice and he's a truth teller. And actually, what's his name? Elliot Gould, The Big Sleep. Who did that film?
It was The Long Goodbye.
The Long Goodbye, and it was written by
Altman.
What's the name of it? Altman. And what's brilliant about that book, and my agent Henry Durnow actually pointed it out, was he's a man with his own value system living in a world that doesn't chime with that value system. And I took that as a kind of style headline, was that he was a man going down a lonely road, that man must go alone, and he's the only person who has that value system, but he's trying to live by that in a world that's quite hostile to it, you know. I think a lot of people feel that way. I think that's one of the things people love about Marlowe, is that, you know, there are things he won't do, and it's very clear from the beginning, you know.
Yeah, he, you know, and he had that, you know, the simple art of murder that you just kind of quoted from, and the code. But also, I like how you set the book in Los Angeles, and it seems to me, I don't know if you agree with this, but do you think that Chandler's Marlowe belongs to a specific time and place?
I do. I think he belongs to 1937 to 1952, maybe, tops, absolute tops. But I think even 52, because the thing is, LA changed so fundamentally around just before and after the war, because there was money flooding down from the mob in Chicago and it corrupted everything. So everything became really decayed, and it was kind of, it was the end of a really hopeful time, I think, when fractures started happening. Then there were the anti-Hispanic race riots. Right. You know, then, you know, the social divisions, the kind of race divisions really started. That was kind of imported from the rest of America. But that was a kind of magical period when, you know, I mean, it's funny being Scottish and writing a book set in LA, but actually I'm no further from that LA than people who live in LA now are. You know, you can't even see the footprint of it. You can see sunset.
There are little ghosts.
There are little ghosts
coming up, you know. You know,
let me just add that the war brought an absolutely gigantic influx of people to California, the war in the Pacific, and it truly changed Southern California, Los Angeles, San Diego, and so forth. My father, who actually was, you know, alive then, remembers going to Los Angeles before the war and how beautiful it was, but how rural it was. You know, there weren't all, and how dramatically it changed in the 50s when the war was over, and all those people who'd come out there to work in defense, all that defense money and so forth, it completely changed it. And you know, the geology of California is not really suited to this much population. It's largely mud, you know, and people, you know, built unsuitable houses and, you know, cities on treacherous land. That's why they're always having earthquakes and fires and so forth. I mean, California, I went to California to college in 1958 when it was still kind of everybody's dream, the golden land, you know, one reason I went to Stanford. And it's not there anymore. Today, it's actually, you know, like a nightmare more than it is a golden place. But Chandler was there before the war. And I think that was his Los Angeles. And he, you know, the transformation of it was part of, along with the alcoholism, I'm sure soured him.
Too. Well, also, the rise of the interstates, you know, really demolished places like Bunker Hill, which you talk about in the book a little bit.
Yeah,
we can see it coming, you know. Denise, have you read your fellow Scott, Robin Robertson's long book-length poem about noir and Los Angeles?
No, I haven't.
It's really,
I know Robin.
It's really something. I wrote a piece about it for the LA Review of Books when it came out. And and I like how you have Skid Row in this book. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but the location, you know, Robin talks a lot about how, you know, the Skid Row at that time post-war was full of veterans, most of them minority veterans, you know, down on their luck, who'd kind of been chewed up and spit out by the system. Really, really interesting. And he talks a lot about Bunker Hill and sort of Dan Fonte's Bunker Hill, that whole period.
I must read that. He's a brilliant poet. I love his work.
I can't remember that. It's the long something, the long fall or something like that.
Do you know, I think somebody told me about it while I was writing the book and I didn't read it because I didn't want to steal his voice.
Yeah, it's really
good. So I think I have it written down somewhere.
It's about a shell-shocked soldier who comes back and ends up in Los Angeles. And that's all I'll say, but it's, you'd love it.
Yeah, but there's lots of footage of LA at that time. And what they did was they got one of these giant old cars and they put a camera in it and they drive around Bunker Hill. And they drive around LA. And like you're saying, Barbara, so much of it is rural. There are all these dusty patches and, you know, on what would be prime sites now. And then you can kind of see like a sort of new town in the background. But it is just such a different place.
Yeah, it really is. It'll be interesting to see what the writer's strike does. You know, one of the things that I have wondered about, you were just talking about cancel culture in this book, Savonarola, a master of cancel culture. And, you know, much of Chandler, especially later Chandler, is really offensive to a lot of modern readers, you know, when you get into sensitivity and all. But yet, I don't think that one should change a word of it because, you know, it's authentic to who he was and when he wrote. So how did you deal with that? How did you deal with, I mean, I don't know since I've read the book, but how did you deal with his, you know, the terminology that he used, which was fairly common then, but would be considered horrendous now?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because I wanted to write a corrective for that, because I think Marlowe as a character, I think that was Chandler. I don't think that's Marlowe as a character from the Marlowe of the early books. So I got the chance to have female characters from other books appear. Anne Reardon appears. And I don't know if you remember Anne Reardon. She's in Farewell, My Lovely. And she wants to be, she saves Chandler. She saves Marlowe's life several times. Well, certainly one time. And she's a brilliant character. You're always thirsting for more of her. And I got to bring her back and she has a job and she has a business in this one. She's got ambitions beyond just getting a boyfriend as some women do, unbelievably. And I got to take him to the gay scene in LA at that time, which was, you know, really thriving. Apparently there isn't a lesbian bar in LA now. And somebody was doing a report at Pride last year. But at that time, the gay scene had loads and loads of cabarets. They had to be very careful who they let in. You know, they had bouncers on the door, but it was really thriving and very unseen. So I got to take him into lots of places that Chandler wouldn't have taken Marlowe and have him not be a bigot, which I think, you know, is, you know, he's, I mean, he's still the man he is. He's still quite a kind of a man of narrow experience. But there's quite a famous Glasgow character called Jimmy the One, who appears in this book. And Jimmy the One was an out gay guy in Glasgow in the early 70s. And he did outreach work to prisons. He was just himself. He was an incredibly dignified, well-respected man, but he was known as Jimmy the One because he was the one out gay guy in Glasgow. And I got to put, and he loved the movies. And I got to put him in this book, in this book, as a very good looking gay guy in LA that people keep trying to make a movie star. I was thinking about John Wayne, actually, how beautiful he was. People keep trying to put Jimmy the One in movies, and he keeps turning up with a boyfriend or being found in the wrong bar. And so really what I wanted to do was write the Marlowe that I wanted to read with Chandler's voice and have him be, have an experience of going to Hispanic bars, you know, not being racist. And he did have a lot of respect for Spanish speakers. I have to say, he did, all the way through the books. And, you know, he corrects other characters when they laugh at people for speaking Spanish. You know, so there was a glimmer of, you know, decency there. So it's a kind of corrective for me. And the particularly the female characters, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Manny Perez, who I thought was one of the key characters in the book. And some of those scenes with them, Marlowe and Manny together, are just magical.
Yeah, so Manny is, this is a very familiar thing if you're from a Catholic background. He's a Hispanic man who has married an Irish woman. They met at chapel, right? And she has a horror of drink, because she's Irish. So of course she marries an alcoholic. Manny's an alcoholic. And she just can't cope with
variety.
Of the hopeless variety. Poor Manny. Anyway, but because Marlowe is a drinker, he knows what's going to happen to Manny, who's refusing to tell him something when he blacks out, and he tricks him into giving very important information. But they go from a dive bar to a bar that's beyond the dive. I mean, it's a deep sea bar that has like a mud floor and a ladder to get down. And Manny gets chucked out because he's so badly behaved in that bar. And, you know, he's just like a working stiff who wouldn't live long. You know, that these people are lost in history. They're just going to melt into the background. Even their families forget them because it's shameful. And I just wanted to honor that guy because, you know, the world's built on those people.
And I like the little detail how you have him. I think you have him from Chavez Ravine, you know, which is a fascinating little tidbit of LA lore.
Yeah.
You know, before Dodger Stadium came in, it was a very vibrant barrio. And
it was an amazing village. I mean, it was a town really, and you know, it had its own culture, it had dances, you know, there were dressmakers there. It was an amazing place, and they just cut the top off it, moved everybody out, and built Dodger Stadium. And as you're saying, they built the freeway around there and basically sliced up the city. And there's a lot of discussion about whether or not that was political. In Scotland, in Glasgow, after the war, they built the freeway in a circle around the centre of Glasgow because they said if there's going to be a communist revolution anywhere in Britain, it's going to be Glasgow, and we can put tanks all around the city and we can stop people, we can kill them. Wow. You know, so that felt very familiar, yeah. That was, I think it was in the cabinet just after the war, they decided to build that.
Robert Moses did that to New York, you know, with the roads that the free expressways and so forth. And it definitely cuts off communities to do that.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of tons of quotable passages that are very Chandler-esque. And there's one that you mentioned the bar that he goes into, and I actually marked this. I stepped in the back door of Hank's. The floor was sticky, the clientele rough, and the beer cold. whoever Hank was, he thought of everything. They had drink and stools and kept the front and back doors propped open for a cross breeze. It smelled of beer and stale cigarettes. I had found heaven. Very Chandler-esque.
No adverbs, right? And hardly.
No.
So just briefly, I mean, we don't want to give away any spoilers, but can you talk just about the basic plot? You know, there's a General Sternwood type character at the beginning of the book, you know, who says Mr. Chadwick Montgomery Esquire. Talk about that story.
So it starts off with him worrying that he's missed something in a previous case that was a cowboy who was murdered, like one of these old cowboys that used to hang about this particular bar. And he's kind of fretting about that. And the call comes through and he doesn't like the tone of the woman on the woman's voice. She's quite haughty. And then he finds out why she's haughty. And it's because she's calling from Montgomery's mansion. And would he like to go up there? And so he switches very quickly from get off the phone to I'll be there in a minute. And he gets up there. Chadwick has lost his daughter and he doesn't really want her back, but his daughter has a kid. And when the kid grows up, he needs to be able to say to him, we tried looking for your mother when she disappeared. So they employ Marlo because they think Marlo won't find her. And they offer him a lot of money, too much money, suspicious amount of money. And Marlo says, no, I only work for my rates because then, you know, I keep my integrity. And they think he's a clown. Anyway, he almost immediately finds her. I think I said she was easier to find than an optimist in the casino. And it turns out that she has deliberately disappeared and she wants to build another life. And she's working in an art gallery. And the gallery is run by basically Peggy Guggenheim, right? So what she's gone to Europe at the start of the war. She's bought up entire studios of these artists. She's bringing them over to America. She's building up their reputation. She's selling their work for loads and loads of money. And this is the world she wants to be in. Now, why she wants to be in there, I won't do a spoiler, but he's sort of keeping an eye on her. He doesn't really know what the score is. And he follows her down to a hotel on Skid Row that she shouldn't really be in. And she's in the room when someone is murdered. And he runs up, helps her get out. And then he has to try and work out what's actually going on and who has enticed her out of this mansion to come to places like Skid Row and witness murders. And what's the benefit of her witnessing this murder?
Right. Now you mentioned Anne Riordan. Is it Riordan or Riordan? How would you pronounce it?
Riordan.
Riordan. Riordan. Anne Riordan.
Yeah.
I love this. There's a quote, you know, she makes reference to the fact that she originally wanted to work for Marlo. He doesn't trust a dame to do the job. That does nice double duty, doesn't it, with you taking on the project.
do you know I'm not really a dame?
No.
Yeah, no, I fraudulently claim to have a damehood because I don't agree with the honor system. but every so often I'm on the news and it says Dame Denise Miner because journalists think it's hilarious. And it was a lot funnier when I was 40, but now it looks as if I could actually be a dame and people give me a hard time on social media for accepting a damehood. I don't really know what to do about it.
Do you have a favorite of Chandler's work?
You know, I think The Long Goodbye, I think, is the best plotted, and I think it deals with that kind of
I think we've lost her briefly here.
A pregnant pause here.
She did say that her internet was rubbish in the evening. I don't know. She should maybe you should black her out and bring her back in.
Let's see.
I think this is a really beautifully written book, and I didn't see where it was going to work out quite what was going on.
Uh-oh, there you are. We lost you, for a moment. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
I said something startlingly insightful.
you were saying, talking about the long goodbye, and then you kind of froze. So you
said sorry.
His best plotted book, but.
Yeah, and also it deals with something that I've never really read about before, which is like a really beguiling friend who's a bit toxic and how loyal he is. I mean, it just puts the whole thing of him being hopelessly loyal to someone who doesn't deserve it, I think is quite lovely. Do you have a favorite? What's your favorite?
It's a toughie. I mean, I really like Farewell, My Lovely. And I do like the long goodbye, you know, although you do get a sense that he put everything but the kitchen sink in there, you know.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask you about, see, my favorite film version of Chandler is the Farewell, My Lovely with Mitchum, Robert Mitchum from the 70s. Have you seen that one?
Do you know, I haven't seen it. And the reason I haven't seen it is because of the age differential between him and the girl. And that's on the poster, and it's like, it just looks like a creepy dad stealing his, it just creeps me out. Is it very good? I love Mitchum.
It was great, yeah, and Charlotte Rampling is in it, and she's fantastic. Good cast. Harry Dean Stanton.
Ooh.
But very good.
Yeah. Is he immortal? He's Harry been around Dean Stanton? Forever. Yeah.
I know. Well, he passed away finally a couple of years ago.
Well, that's a rumor.
A rumor, yeah, right. Now, how do you feel about Hammett? Because a lot of writers either seem to be Hammett or Chandler or both. What do you think?
I'm both.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I really am both. And I can see why people find Chandler more accessible now because Hammett wrote in such a particular way. But I think it's like, you know, neither of those two guys would give us stuff, whether, you know, a kind of post-punk from Glasgow woman liked their stuff. So I feel like I don't have to take a side. We didn't have a lot of respect for women. I actually wrote an introduction to The Thin Man, the relaunch of The Thin Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It was a real pleasure to do, actually. Yeah, I'd forgotten how much I loved him because I read him so long ago. And people don't talk about him so much, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have that kind of currency, you know?
I think his language is so spare that many people just don't bond to it. I was never able to read Red Harvest, for example. And I did an informal poll once when we were gathered. Patrick, I think you were there at the Orpheum. To talk about The Thin Man. I don't even remember why, but anyway, there I was leading the discussion. And I asked for a show of hands about how many people had read The Thin Man as opposed to watching the film with Bacall. And most people knew it only from the film. They had never actually read it. And, you know, I think Chandler's prose is so richer. Whether you believe, you know, whether you like that or not, I think that's why more people bond to him because, you know, I mean, you can hardly beat a phrase like, you know, last night when the jacaranda trees were in bloom. I'm quoting Michael Conley because that was the line that he liked when we talked about Chandler. But, you know, his imagery is really beautiful.
Yeah. And he paints a scene. That's something Hammett doesn't really do. You know, he doesn't tell you what the furniture is. But The Thin Man was such a seminal book for crime fiction. It is a cross between noir and a cozy. It is an amazing book. It has puzzle elements and it has noir and it has, because a drinking couple living in a hotel, friends with people from different social strata was outrageous then. But you know, the central thing about The Thin Man is, they find a body and the body is wearing fat man clothes, so they assume it's a fat man, and it turns out it was actually a thin man who was murdered, and that's like the central thing. I've ruined that for everybody now, but apparently that was inspired because he was living at the Pierre and had run up a massive bill and couldn't afford to pay it, so he put all his clothes on and snuck out of the pier and went to a cheaper hotel. And that's where the idea from the Thin Man came from, which is
Is that the best
wow. origins, isn't that great origins?
That's fantastic.
I mean, that's where heart to heart comes from. That's where any husband and wife duo, crime busters comes from, is from the Thin Man. You know, it's so seminal. We don't talk about it because it was very commercially successful, I think.
Maybe so, yeah. Have you read, I read a couple of years ago, The Dane Curse, which I'd never read before. And it was—
No, I haven't read that.
It's such a bizarre and interesting book. Really liked it a lot. You should check it out.
Yeah. I wonder why it is that both of them were alcoholics. You know, I'm not sure what kind of comment that is, that both Hammett and Chandler, you know, just drink was, you know, maybe their muse and certainly their undoing. So,
well, you know, Hammett should have written so much more than he did.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, and the reason he didn't was because of the drink. And Chandler was so profoundly unhappy. I mean, it's you know, when you read his later letters, they're really heartbreaking. And, you know, it's just awful sad. You just think, what did we lose because of that, you know, because of that illness, you know?
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, comparing their letters, because I think, you know, Chandler's letters are almost as interesting as the novels. You know, I mean, he just bleeds all over the page, doesn't he?
Yeah. I think he's quite drunk when he's writing letters. He's very disinhibited. Yeah, he's very disinhibited in a way that's, you know, his language in the letters is amazing. I mean, he's not putting it on for the books. He's not assuming, you know what I mean? I mean, I remember I knew a crime writer and he used to wear a hat to write, and because he was assuming a persona. And I don't think he got published after his first book, but you know, that was who he was 24/7. He was always clipping words together. He took real joy in that. Do you feel that from his letters?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. I need to go back and revisit those. Yeah, whereas, you know, Hammett's letters are, as you would imagine, very clipped and not terribly revealing.
Hmm.
But yeah.
Did you know that Pinkerton came from Glasgow?
No.
He came from Glasgow, and he was he left Glasgow because he was a Chartist and thought everyone should have the vote, and he couldn't get any work, so he left and went to America.
Really?
That's where he came. Yeah.
Wow.
And became very, very right wing. And actually, you know, they were shooting at trade unionists in the steel mills owned by Carnegie and Frick. And almost as soon as they mowed down all these striking workers, Carnegie refused ever to see Frick again and started his foundation and gave away a whole lot of money, whitewashing his reputation.
That's so every time you're in those libraries.
Do you know what I mean? Swings and roundabouts, you know, lots of dead workers, a lovely hall. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, if you know, every great fortune is built on a great crime. Then you can see that, you know, people want to whitewash. Look at Rockefeller. I mean, you know, he was a pirate beyond pirates, crushed lives, ruined lives, the whole bit. And then, you know, it's like, you know, Bill Gates turning into a philanthropist, or God knows what Elon Musk might decide to do one day. I don't know. I keep hoping he's going to sort of just dissolve into X. I love the fact that San Francisco made them take down the X sign today. Yay.
Good from them.
I know. So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we can sit here and talk about Chandler and Hammett and all of that, but, you know, it'd be fun if we could live another 50 years and then talk about, you know, writers of today or things of today. It's always easier to look back and understand what's going on than it is figure it out while it's actually happening.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll look back and they'll say, if she wasn't so addicted to hot yoga, she could have written so much more. If she didn't have all those dogs, how much TikTok. More could she have got done?
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating how many people have written a Chandler, from Robert Parker to, didn't John Banville write a Chandler?
John Banville, Joe Eday.
Joe Eday just has written one too. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, he so tried doing a contemporary
thing. You know, there is really something compelling. And of course, for those of you who don't know this, you know, a writer's estate, if there is one, has to actually authorize stuff like that. Or, you know, and not every dead author has a literary estate. So I'm always counseling authors when they come to the store to give real thought to a literary estate, because if you don't, you don't have, you know, there are many bad things that can happen if you have the kind of literary output that somebody might want to continue. And a lot of people don't think about that. You know, creative people don't necessarily go in that direction, but it's really worth a thought. But in the case of Chandler, there is an estate. I think there's a Hammett estate too, but I'm not entirely sure. There certainly is a Conan Doyle estate, which is a thorn on everybody's side for years.
The problem with Hammett is Hammett was charged with and found guilty in a civil court of rape. So that is the problem with Hammett, is nobody wants to touch it because it is a bag of poison. This was like, I think, in the 30s, which when it was almost impossible to get a conviction. So although he was, he had a great kind of he was a political activist, you know, he was persecuted, he refused to give names. I mean, he was really a really honorable man. There's a lot of dark stuff there as well.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Mm.
Yeah. Which, you know, to get a conviction, well, to get a case against you and have to pay somebody damages after a finding of the court.
Yeah,
was a big deal in those. I mean, it was very clear what had happened. I think if you really want to live on after your death, you have to have a lot of children who are unemployable, and you need an estate. That's really what you need. You need children who need to live off your work. And, that really is how to live on, I think. That's the way to do it. I'm too late. Oh,
is this a one-off thing for you, Denise? You know, you've written your Chandler and that's it?
Do you know, I would love to do another one. I really would. I would love to do another one. I'm so interested in people passing for white. And, you know, in LA at that time, and I grew up in Paris where racial divides were very different. So, you know, people of African origin in Paris were really not... there wasn't a lot of prejudice against people. Algerians, you couldn't get a job or housing. But, you know, I thought it would be very interesting for somebody from that background to go to LA and try to navigate the racial divides there. Because obviously, you know, as a white person, you can't really, I don't think, you know, you can properly represent the experience of African Americans. But I thought, you know, a black Parisian, you probably could talk about that. And I think that's really interesting, because one of the things about Chandler is he goes into all these unseen worlds, and that's what's so beautiful about him. So going into the gay scene and going into, you know, kind of that sort of racial divide, I think that would be fascinating, and how he uncovers the truth in these different worlds, these interlocking worlds that LA was at that time. So we'll see anyway.
How about an Anne Reardon novel?
I know, you could have a whole series of Anne Reardon.
Yeah, you could just remove Marlowe entirely, just from her and her agency.
He could just turn up sometimes and save her from a dope fiend or something.
Right.
But she has a lady detective agency, and she's deciding in this book whether or not she's going to make the kind of moral compromises that anyone who sets up a business has to make. Is she going to deal with, you know, she's dealing with mob money, but at the same time, they're less corrupt than the politicians that she's strong-arming. And she's setting up a spy network of cigarette girls who are like the unseen ears all around LA. So they know everything that's going on, and nobody thinks they can hear because they've got good legs. So, I mean, I think that would be great. You know, I think she's so cool, Anne Reardon. She's got her own house. She dresses really well. You know, her dad was a cop who was run off the force by corrupt cops. She knows the score. She's a writer. She, you know, she writes for magazines, and she has a car and a gun. She's so cool.
And of course, LA was, you know, thick with Germans at that time, you know, especially Hollywood, lots of Germans there.
Yeah. Well,
look at questions.
Yeah. Let's see. Mainly just comments. My grandfather introduced me to Chandler when I was a teenager and I fell in love with his work, says Susan. Someone's pointing out a podcast about the Maltese Falcon recently and about the whole. Yeah. So that's going to be in the comments if you want to check that out.
Oh, great.
Let's see. Let me check, check YouTube. Mainly just people are very interested and want to read the book.
Wonderful. Well, that's kind of what we're here for. I would like to recommend, if you're a Chandler fan, you haven't seen it, that you find the director's cut DVD of The Big Sleep, because, you know, it's a movie, again, like The Thin Men. Many people think they know Chandler from the movie. But if you see it with the director's cut, you will see that in the interest of promoting Lauren Bacall, two or three scenes that were actually critical to the plot got cut out of the movie as we saw it. And it's really interesting to see it as it would have been had they left those scenes in. I was completely enthralled by it. And
does it make sense more?
Yes, the actual pivotal scene where the plot makes sense is the one that got cut off so Lauren Bacall got more focused. Seriously, I mean, I was really just blown away by it. And I just can't recommend enough, because, you know, there's such a thing about translating, you know, literary stories into film. And it's a classic example of how, you know, the exigencies of the movies and casting and all the rest of it can change a story almost unrecognizably for people. And yet many people think that The Big Sleep is the book.
I thought the film didn't make sense because they couldn't mention pornography or drugs.
No,
which is what it's about.
Find the director's cut and you will see that there's a whole scene in the DA's office that hit the floor because they wanted to give Lauren Bacall more face time. And that's the scene where the plot actually makes sense.
I have a quick question for you, Denise, maybe a final one, which is just about the language and the editing process. What was that like in rewriting the book? Did you find any Scottishisms or little subtle turns of phrase that weren't American sneaking in that your editor caught?
Did I though? I mean, I think there were words that I got wrong. I can't think what they were. One of the difficulties is no one says hi and no one says yeah. And you realize how, yes, people don't say that yet. They say sure, and people don't say okay. And you realize how, you know, those shortened versions of things, you really kind of come to rely on them. But I don't think, I mean, I very often get words wrong. So I would say curtains or, you know, what else would I say? I don't know. Something about clothes. It was quite hard to get the right terminology for clothes because, you know, like, certain types of pants or certain types of suits would be called one thing in LA and a different thing in New York. And, you know, getting things like that right. I actually wanted to come out to LA and drive an Oldsmobile because in James M. Cain, the car makes such a difference to the plot in The Postman Only Rings Twice. And I thought it'd be great to have something about how these old cars actually operated, you know. But I never got the chance to do that because of lockdown. But I can't really remember the editing process, but it wasn't that extensive, I don't think.
Yeah. You know? Once you got into the voice, did it just feel very natural?
Yeah, it did. I actually felt like going to visit an old friend every day when I sat down at the desk. It was, I mean, it's such an act of love, do you know what I mean? Because I love his work so much. And I know a lot of people don't read his work because they pick up the wrong book and they're like, this is just racist rubbish, you know, or all the women are trying to kiss him for all the time for no, it's never really explained why. I have a feeling that Chandler read James Bond and got slightly poisoned by those books, so he becomes kind of the ultimate man at some point, Marlowe, in the stories, and he's right about everything and he's quite humorless and everyone fancies him. Which, I mean, I don't know if you've read all the Bond books, but they're awful. They're awful. I don't know why these films are still being made. They're dreadful. And I think he was slightly poisoned by it. I don't think he knew why people loved his work so much.
Have you heard that BBC interview when Chandler came to the UK and interviewed Fleming?
No, I haven't, because I know he's wasted in it.
It's pretty interesting. Yeah.
And you can is, hear, it? Is it?
You can hear them smoking.
Right.
You know, no, but it's interesting how Fleming kind of defers to Chandler in the interview. Right. Yeah, yeah. Ooh. Worth checking out. Well, what's next for you, Denise? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm working on a book about a forensic scientist who realizes that her discipline is junk science, which I think is fascinating. Every generation has science that seems absolutely set in stone, and every generation discovers that this is absolute rubbish. Forensic odontology, bite marks. Rubbish. I studied it at university. Apparently it's absolute rubbish. It's the only reason Ted Bundy was convicted. Bite marks. Blood spatter, as we all know from the staircase. Really not that much of a science. You know, it's kind of good guessing, really. So I thought that would be fascinating, and how that could, you know, how difficult it gets when you're older and you're really invested in things staying the same to participate in change. And I was really thinking about climate change, you know. And I noticed myself becoming comfortable and, you know, having a car and justifying it. And, you know, I noticed myself, you know, trying not to think about climate change or about how people who have nothing. And when I was young, I said to myself, I will never forget what this is like, and I will not be one of those oblivious older people. And now I am one of those oblivious older people. And I thought, what would it take for somebody to actually reverse their lifetime and take that risk? So it's called Unthinkable.
Wow.
It's wonderful that you can just kind of follow your muse. You know, it's such an interesting career when, you know, you write what story comes to you.
I'm so lucky. Mm. You know, Barbara, I am so lucky that I've never had a massive bestseller. That's what did for Hammett, The Thin Man did for Hammett. He wrote that same book over and over and over again. He didn't fulfill his last contract because it's so beguiling. And actually, I think I've had the best career because I can just do all these different things. Before lockdown, I'd done a breath play. You know, I do radio plays. I just get to do loads and loads and loads of different things, and really just following my nose and following my interests. And I get to read all the time and listen to podcasts all the time. And, you know, I'm just incredibly lucky. I'm so grateful.
It's an interesting thought, but I think it's true that having a success is intimidating and creates its own sort of set of strictures. It's very hard to, you know, it's really hard to think about if you have some, you know, Gone Girl or Da Vinci Code or Silence of the Lambs or something. I think it would be dreadfully hard to sit down and write another book.
And also, a lot of people are depending on you. It's not just about you on your own. The publishers are depending on you. You know, the publicists are depending on you. Bookshops are depending on you. You know, I mean, I would think, especially for people when that happens very early in their career, yeah. I think it can really change the course of their life.
No, I agree. I think if success like that, which is unpredictable, really, you know, comes along later, everybody's better equipped to handle it. It's an interesting question. Not being creative myself, I don't really know what kind of effect, you know, having a wild success would have on one's creativity, whether it would be scary or whether it'd be inspiring. I really don't know. But, mm-hmm. you know, I agree with you. You've had a wonderful career, and you know, it's so successful that you can do whatever you want, but it's not so successful that you are forced to think about all that. So, you know, you're in a very sweet spot, aren't you?
Really sweet spot. Really sweet spot. I'm going to go on fire as soon as I hang up this Zoom call. You know, that something awful's going to happen. I feel like I'm bringing down a curse on myself, acknowledging how lucky
I can step outside and immediately catch fires. Right. But anyway, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for agreeing to spend an hour with us. And as I understand it, you're doing some kind of a program on Thursday. on Zoom with your publisher, but I can't remember what it is. Do you want to tell people in case they need to join?
It's Crime and Cocktails. So it's Cocktail Hour, and I'll be talking about Chandler. And the link is on my Instagram. And Mulholland Books will be instaing the link as well. They're going to give you a recipe for cocktails, and we're going to talk Chandler.
Wonderful. Well, it might be a different conversation, but you know, if you're this, it certainly will be a different conversation. If you've enjoyed this, then you might want to tune in and listen to Denise over drink, which has also been part of this conversation, although we're not drinking. But anyway, it's such a treat. So I hope to see you again soon. I hope you might come and visit us next year.
Yeah.
Right.
So let me again recommend very short read, but really profound, practically life-changing, Three Fires. Says so much about the state of the world today and how we're all behaving and who's in charge. And then Patrick will tell you how much he loves The Second Murder, which I'm going down to the bookstore and retreat from.
It's brilliant.
So I can read a copy. Yeah, yay. Anyway, thanks very much, everybody, for watching. And enjoy the rest of your day or the rest of your evening. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Denise.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.